Underworld. Disc 22.
Manx Martin. Chapter 3. He walks along the curving base of the stadium wall, under the blue and white bunting, and he is trying to spot an easy mark. He is in the crowd, a large and moving swarm, elbows and shoulders, faces suddenly jutting eye to eye, and they're still coming down from the elevated train station, men and boys, talking and whooping. And the line is forming for bleacher seats, even though the gates won't open until 9 in the morning, hours from now. And they're coming up from the subway and streaming out of the local streets. And he walks some more, caught up in the rush of sensation, flags flying and emblems bejeweling the high wall, and a second long line, this one for standing room tickets. Men eating and drinking, some sitting in beach chairs covered with blankets. And Manx goes walking through clouds of cigar smoke and sees whiskey flasks showing here and there with caps on chains. Now what does he do? Does he look for some high jiver from Harlem? A giant fan all flush with victory and ready to drop some dollars on a genuine all-time souvenir? Won't work, Manx thinks. Black man's not going to believe anything he says. Think I'm some fool running a penny hustle. Black man's going to look him down with that saucy eye he's got for outrageous plots against his person. No, got to go white. Only way to go. Besides, the number's mostly white, so it's the percentage play. A happy rumble. The street is one big buzz and rumble, a steady roar of talk and song and people calling to each other, filled with good feeling. Manx walks over to two men. He does this on an impulse, in the spirit of why not, and because he doesn't want to stand around all night studying faces and calculating odds, even though that's exactly what he ought to be doing, and he knows it, and he'd planned to do it, but the best-laid plans, like the man says, have a habit of collapse. His hand grips the baseball. He keeps his hand outside the jacket pocket, and he grips the ball through the cloth. And in the spirit of good feeling, in the swelling presence of two groups of fans, Giants and Yankees, both winners this year, a happy, steady, join-in roar that brings him up and gives him heart. He walks over to two men standing on line in front of one of the booths.
"Excuse me. Something here you might be interested in."
He talks to them. He tells them about the baseball. This is the baseball that the guy hit into the stands, the home run that won the game. And the longer he talks, the more unbelievable he sounds to himself. He can't even believe this is him talking. His voice sounds like something released from an air mattress when you pull out the nipple. The two men seem to step back, although it's probably not actual physical motion, so much as a wishful maneuver he sees in their eyes.
"I'm talking what is a fact, whatever it sounds," he says. "This is a thing that happened at the ballpark across the river."
And he knows he is working now at restoring a certain self-respect, never mind making a sale. One guy says, "I don't think so, no, not interested." "You interested?" Other guy says, "Not interested." Manx takes the ball out of his pocket. He's not sure why he's doing this, since it proves nothing except the fact that he has a ball, at least he has a ball. And he holds it much the way his son Cotter had held it earlier in the evening, gripping it in one hand, spinning it with the other. Hard-eyed and defiant. Then he turns and walks away, feeling their looks, seeing smirks so clear he could draw them with a pencil, and going small, bristling a little at the back of the neck, and going smaller with every step. He walks a little ways. He always thought he'd like to get himself a flask, flat enough to pocket conveniently, with a cap on a chain. He puts the ball back in his pocket and walks out past the wooden barricades near Gate 4. You got these guys come out here think they own the earth. He remembers he's supposed to write a letter excusing his son from school because he's got a fever of 102, which is a secret they are keeping from the boy's mother. Not the fever, but the letter. The fever is a made-up deal. He stands and watches a while. Then he gets an idea. He watches, thinking there's crowds of people, and I'm holding something every last one of them would like to own. But who's going to believe a story that comes out of nowhere? Then he realizes what he ought to be doing. He gets an idea. He gets it from the crowd. He ought to be looking for fathers and sons. Get the man to do it for the boy. Appeal to the man's, whatever, his rank as a father, his soft spot, his willingness to show off a little, impress the boy, make the night extra special. And yes, there are men who have brought their sons here tonight, as an adventure, you know. A fair number of sons on the scene. As a thing you want the boy to experience, staying up all night to buy World Series tickets. See, even if the man doesn't believe it, the boy will. And Max can imagine a little conspiracy in the making. The father and the hustler working as a team to make the boy believe the baseball's real. It takes these turns of mind to work a deal. He begins to prowl the lines, to scout the prospects standing on line along the high wall. He checks out faces and attitudes. He doesn't want to rush. He follows the wall in a westerly direction and sees what he thinks he might be looking for, finally. The kid's maybe 11. The man's pulling a sandwich from a gym bag, and they're standing there in total innocence of his approach. He does his intro, which he takes to be the toughest part, making the details clear, and he looks from man to boy and back, trying to get them both involved. And it seems to be going well, and the man tears the sandwich and gives half to the kid, and they look at Manx and eat. They are listening and chewing, and he tries to read their looks. He is stymied, though, by the names involved, the players at the climax. He doesn't know their names, faces, numbers, all the things the fans know from childhood to the day they die. And this slows his narrative and muddies it up, and he tries to compensate by taking out the baseball. Now the man is talking through a mouthful of food.
So what you're saying is, you're telling me, in other words,
white meat and lettuce are showing behind his teeth.
That's right. You got it,
Manx says, hearing himself adopt a high pitch that's meant to be cheerful and optimistic. But the man's not looking at the baseball. He's looking at Manx.
And I'm supposed to stand here.
Manx begins to understand, close range, that this guy's a bus driver or sewer worker or bricklayer.
And listen to this bullcrap.
The man is chewing and talking.
I think you better haul ass out of here, buddy, before I call a cop.
Manx puts the ball back in his pocket.
They put son-of-a-bitches like you behind bars is where you belong.
Talking like that in front of his own kid. The kid is hungry. He's going through the lettuce like a lawnmower. They're standing there eating, both of them looking at Manx, and the son resembles the father to such a degree, stocky and full face, that Manx wants to warn him against growing up.
Think they own the earth.
It takes him an hour, scouting the lines, doing three circuits of the stadium, talking to this and that person, getting a feel for the individual, seeing how it goes, and it's not going well, giving himself another 5 minutes by the clock on the wall at the southwest end, and then 5 more minutes, telling himself if he doesn't spot someone in 5 minutes with a wholesome kid in tow, he will give up and go home. And then 1 more minute, and then 1 more, prowling the lines, making approaches that don't pan out. And about an hour later, he is talking to a man and his son who are squatted down outside the bleacher section near the end of a very long line, camped out with a sleeping bag for the kid and a duffel coat for the man, and Manx is working his way into the names.
Which I'm saying, in all honesty.
Wait a minute. You're saying this baseball you claim to have in your possession.
Right, right, right. But I don't know the player's name, you understand. Which I'm being honest with you.
You mean Bobby Thompson?
That's the one. All right. I feel better now.
See, Manx believes he can be straight up with this man, expose his own shortcomings. He's not a fan and shouldn't pretend to be. And at the same time, only deeper, he thinks this is a strategy that can work. It's a scheme, a plot. Show the man your weakness, and he will swallow your story whole.
I'm of the attitude where, if you're doing a little business, you put all your cards on the table. And I tell you what I think. That tomorrow a wholesale rabble show themselves at the clubhouse entrance, carrying a baseball, every one of them, and saying, I got the ace.
When in fact, according to your claim, the man says.
When in fact, the ace is in the hole, Max says.
And he reaches into his pocket and takes out the ball. The man smiles. The man is on his haunches against the wall, and Manx is in a squat himself, holding the ball slightly a-tremble for comic effect, staring hard at the man, showing the man a fake intensity, which they both know is fake, just for effect. And the man holds out his hand for the ball, amused but skeptical, meaning, in other words, that he'll play along for now. But Manx doesn't give him the ball. The boy is sitting up in the sleeping bag, trying to stay awake.
Now, see this tar spot?
Manx says. And he shows the man, and he shows the boy.
I think I ought to rub it off, being it has no business here.
And he wets his thumb with a flourish and tries to remove a scant trace of tar, because Cotter must have bounced the ball in the street. But he only succeeds in smudging the area, and has to wonder why he is doctoring the ball at all. By the way, the fellow says, maybe to distract Manx from his embarrassment. My name's Charlie.
You call me Manx. And the boy, what's your name, son?
Tell him.
No,
the kid says.
We got us a rascal here, Manx says. How old's this rascally son of a gun?
8, the man says.
8? Imagine being 8. Imagine going to the first game of the World Series and seeing all these famous players. Something he'll remember for the rest of his life.
His name's Chucky. Manx looks at Chucky. Kid'd rather be home sleeping in a soft, warm bed with dog drawings on the wall. That's okay. What we're talking about here is not the present, but the future. Pop's looking to build memory for the boy.
Being 8, Yankee Stadium. Most famous ballpark in the country.
Manx puts the ball in the man's hand. But if a dozen people show up with baseballs at the clubhouse entrance, Charlie says, how do I convince anyone? How do I convince myself this is the Bobby Thompson ball? Or anyone else? Manx in his crapshooter's squat.
Let me put it this way, he says.
And he doesn't shy from the question, because he's been waiting for it ever since he walked across the bridge from Harlem.
Do they believe you or me? Who do they believe? Put yourself in their place, friends of yours, people in the office. Then look at me and look at you. Who are they going to believe?
Manx knows the logic in this argument is about 6 times removed from the question of the ball's actual history. But he thinks he can count on this fellow to see the underlying subject, the turn of mind.
And I can believe it, personally, myself, he says, because my own boy gives me the goods on this baseball. And no way on earth he's going to lie to the old man about a thing like this. He'll lie, all right. Lie about school, miss school, tell a lie, miss a visit to the dentist.
But this is baseball, Charlie says helpfully.
Exactly right. But I have to admit I wasn't convinced at first. Like you, like anyone. I was first gave over to doubt. But then I heard the boy.
And you felt you knew.
I felt exactly I knew. Because I heard it in his voice.
And saw it as well?
Saw it right there. Wouldn't lie about this. Good boy when it counts.
And baseball. This counts. Manx takes heart from the man's cooperation because he doesn't want to suffer another bring-down. But at the same time, he doesn't want to think of Charlie as a sucker, a rube in a duffel coat, falling for an easy line. The line is true in this case, but what's the difference? Manx has told amazing lies that were a lot easier falling from his lips than anything he could say about this little spheroid fact. The man is studying the ball. Manx decides to shut his mouth for 15 seconds. Let the occasion take a solemn turn. Give the customer a chance to fall in love with the product. Well, I see there's a little sort of green paint smudge near the seam here, between the seam and the trademark, Charlie says. And I know for a fact, because someone said so on the radio, that the ball struck a pillar when it went in the stands. And the pillars are green. I also know for a fact at the Polo Grounds.
Manx does a little squat jump. He is elated to hear this. It's as though he himself has to be convinced, as though the man's remark is the confirmation he needs to see Cotter as an honest boy, transformed from a back-talking kid who jumps turnstiles into an honest, upright, dutiful boy at last. The man raises his eyes from the ball and looks at Manx. It's a look that says, "I want to believe." And Manx can't think of a thing to say for the life of him, the actual life, that would bring the man across the line and clinch the deal completely. Charlie takes up the task himself, says some fairly convincing things, this time to his son, about the company that makes the ball and the name of the league president that stamped on the ball and other matters and details, all of them checking out okay, it seems. And the boy is sleepy and cold and unimpressed, and Manx looks around for a vendor with hot chocolate because it never hurts to be considerate. Vendor's scarce tonight. He had some soup. I was a vendor, I'd be out here in force. Put the wife and kids to work. He had hot soup and a thermos, he's all right. But Chucky says, "I don't think I'm so all right." "Just stay awake. I want you awake for this." Manx understands this is for his benefit more than the kid's. The man and the kid just going through the motions. Kid's not even doing that. Kid stopped listening to the man somewhere around the diaper stage. Chucky slithers into the bag with that mutinous look kids get once they understand they're not property. "I want you to remember everything that happens here tonight," Charlie says. But the boy is already down under, even his head vanished in the flannel. "You're a father, you must know," Charlie says. "I wrote the book." What a danger-laden thing it is, in all respects, trying to raise a child. Take forever to grow up on the one hand, but it goes so fast on the other. "I've only got the one." "You're looking at four." "Four," Charlie says. And in his look there is admiration, sympathy, and some wonder as well. And something else Manx can't quite identify. Maybe just the sense of different lives, a thing that has nothing directly to do with the number of kids. There's a fire going in an oil drum, and Manx goes to the curb, grabs the rusty can, and drags it over to the line of waiting fans, fire and all. He feels the metal burn his hand as an afterthought, burn like hell in a picture book. But the fans are impressed by the gesture, big smiles abounding. It is the kind of thing that rightly marks a night like this, and Charlie seems delighted. But not just different lives, completely other ways of thinking and doing. And Manx isn't sure if they're supposed to be sad about this. He's ready to do whatever's called for. "What kind of seats you expecting to get?"
"Bleachers. Love to get reserved seats, but they're long gone. Everything's gone but bleachers and standing room. And I know Chucky'll never forgive me if I force him to watch a ball game standing up."
"After he spends a night sleeping on the sidewalk? Who can blame him?"
Charlie smiles again, throwing a wayward slap at Manx's kneecap. Then he hands Manx the ball, but only because he's reaching into his coat for something. Turns out to be a flask, sweet little silvery thing with a cap on a chain like those army canteens, only flat, small, expensive, that you can pocket easy. A pick-me-up on a down day.
"Now, what have we here?" says Manx.
"Give you one guess."
"Could say orange juice."
"Too soon for breakfast."
"Could say spicy tea from old India."
"Too late for tea time," Charlie says. They're having a pretty good time, the one on his haunches against the wall, the other in his crapshooter's squat, with a lump in the flannel bag gone totally still, either pouty stiff or sleep stiff. Charlie says, "Do the honors." And he hands the flask to Manx, who tosses the ball back to Charlie. And this small, blurry exchange has an odd depth. It's a sign of some kind, a deal that's completely outside the transaction in progress, and it brings Manx up a little higher. He unscrews the cap and lets it dangle, and he takes a connoisseur's sniff of the action in the jug.
"Do believe this is what they call spirits?"
"Irish whiskey," Charlie says.
We do love the Irish, don't we?
Many lasting contributions, Charlie says.
Well said, my man.
They share a complicit grin, and Manx raises the flask and tilts his head and knocks back a not-too-sizable shot, for courtesy's sake, and gives the thing back to Charles. He calls him Charles now for the social aspect, gentlemen drinkers at the club. And he waits for Charles to drink. A moment of stinging truth. Manx has put his mouth to the rim of the flask, and now he waits for Charles to do the same. A brief, deep, and knowledgeable suspense. Doesn't even wipe off the rim. Just tips the flask and drinks too deep, and comes up teary-eyed and gasping, but happy, too. Both men happy, having a princely time.
"Went down the wrong pipe,"
says Charlie, forcing out the words.
"Happens to the best."
"Occupational hazard,"
says the gasping man. Hands over the flask. Manx takes a Klondike swig and keenly feels the effect, oh yes, as the Irish aerates a number of crucial passages in his head and chest. They pass the flask a while.
"One of mine's a girl," Manx says. "Rosie. Best ever daughter you could find."
"How old?"
"How old?"
he says. He feels a drifty look come into his eyes.
"Maybe twice yours. Yours 8, right? Imagine being 8.
They pass the flask. "I'll be honest," Charlie says. "You were honest with me. Least I can do is tell you what I'm thinking." All up and down the line, there are people crouched in sleep or in drowsy, bundled waiting, out of conversation now, heads slumped, some cigarettes going. Most people asleep in blankets or thick parkas, or just nodding off, squinch-eyed. And a cough and a moan and a radio playing Latin music, but not too loud. And shaking awake and nodding off, and a cop on a horse over by the barricade. And Manx shifts position slightly to observe the stillness of the tall brown animal. A dead-still quality that is not like men when they are motionless. Or dogs, for that matter. Or fish in a bowl. And not peaceful or unperturbed, but immobile in its own way, great and strong, shining at the flanks.
"I'll be honest," Charlie says, "because what's the point of all this if we're not honest?"
"Go, man."
"I don't know if you're telling me the truth, but the ball looks like a ball they'd be using in a National League game in the year 1951. That's one mark in your favor. Relatively minor, because there's balls and there's balls.
And there's ball breakers."
They pass the flask. "And the other mark is the major mark. I look at you and I don't think I see a con man or a liar."
A brief pause.
"Then you the first,"
Manx says. They laugh and stop and laugh again. It's one of those jokes that reverberates for 10 or 20 seconds, bouncing around the premises, one meaning echoing into another. And it's only a matter now of signing on the line.
"How much?" says Charlie. Manx looks away. He hasn't come this far in his tactics and plans, and he doesn't know how much. But he feels himself get tense. The horse makes a snuffling sound behind him.
"It's entirely up to yourself,"
he says, and feels immediately, unspecifically, cheated. Charlie holds the ball in both hands now, pressed up under his chin.
"See, I don't know what I'm buying," he says. "This is a consideration we have to keep in mind. Sure, buyer beware and all that, but we're talking about an object that belongs properly to the heart."
"You don't want to squeeze the eagle on me, do you, boss?" "Entirely up to yourself, because I trust you to do right. You know your baseball. A fan. I want a fan to own this thing," Manx says.
He feels his gaze sliding away, drifting inward, and notes a certain tightness in his chest. Charles. Charles is suddenly all decisive. A little lull, you see, with the mention of money. But suddenly Charles is sliding up the wall to dig into his pockets, and he's all bustle and rush. Manx tips the flask and drinks. Pulling bills out of two or three pockets, and uncrumpling a five, and smoothing out a single. Manx looks down the line at the nodding heads, men breathing steam in the chill air, sleepers and dreamers deep in the night. The sum arrived at looks like this. A 10, two fives, another 10, two singles, a quarter, two nickels, and a tiddlywink dime. Plus the kid pops out of the camp bag. Charlie says, "I want you to take it all because it's all I've got. Even the change. I want you to even have the change because I got the ticket money here." And he pounds his chest. "And the car keys here." And he slaps his thigh. "And I want you to have every nickel in my pocket above and beyond." Manx thinks all right. He tries to keep his eyes from fluttering while they count. He thinks this is more than he could have gotten for those snow shovels he boosted from the utility room in his building. Plenty more. A hell of a lot, actually, more. The small, angry head is jutting from the bag. "I want to go home now," Chucky says. Manx takes the money. He licks his thumb to count it for the benefit of the kid. Says some things to the kid, feeling good, trying to draw half a laugh. Says to Charlie, "Bought yourself a souvenir of the great game. Calls for a drink, old boy." They pass the flask, and this is the only thing in the course of the long night and early morning that seems to engage Chucky. The sight of two men guzzling booze right out of the bottle. Half sigh, half pain in the sound they make when they open their mouths to exhale the fumes, eyes tight and pink. Charles arches his fleecy brows. "Now that the ball is mine, what do I do with it?" Manx retakes the flask.
"Show it around. Tell your friends and neighbors. Then put it in a glass case with the fancy dishes. You saw those crowds go crazy in the street. This is bigger than some wars I've seen."
Manx has no idea what he means by this. The Irish is beginning to talk. He sees that Charlie is feeling slightly down at the moment. Charlie is probably passing from the stage of half-belief to the stage of disbelief, feeling rooked and beetle-brained, slid out of his honest wages by some rogue off the street with a tale so staggering Charlie's embarrassed to tell his friends. Let the buyer, like they say, beware. He tries to think of the word that means a thing will increase in value over the years, but the Irish is not only talking, it is thinking, and anyway, it's probably not a good idea at this point to say encouraging things to Charles. Only sound phony, won't it? They look at each other. Charles has the baseball and the flask, and Manx has the money. Okay. It is one of those happenstances where the mood downshifts once the deal is made. Only normal. The boy is asleep now, his face partly visible over the flap, and Manx wonders if he'll recall any of this, ever, or if it's already sunk in the dreaming part of his mind, the vague shape of a crouched man who was part of the night. Charles looks at Manx and smiles, complicatedly, with an element of drowned affection in the mix. Then they shake hands wordlessly, and Manx is on his feet and out of there, feeling a slight ache in his calves and a hard, tight, serious-minded pain in his left hand from dragging the fire drum across the sidewalk. Put some butter on it when he gets home. He walks past the humped and bundled bodies and the smoky grills where some of them cooked their meals, and he walks past the cop on the tall horse and goes back across the bridge and up to Broadway, and maybe there's the faintest line of light low in the eastern sky. It occurs to him. A lot of things occur to him, all dulled by drink. But it occurs to him that he doesn't want to stand on an empty platform under the street waiting for a train. He walks down Broadway and begins to wonder why the man gave him the change in his pockets. There wasn't any need for coins to be changing hands. Maybe it was just what the fellow said, the heartfelt thing of wanting to give whatever's on your person, giving the shirt off your back. Or maybe it's an honest deal that two men make, and one of them turns it into a handout. He walks. He wants to walk, but he doesn't want to reach home. Ever, necessarily. He has to think this out. How he has the right to enter into money matters concerning any object that belongs to his family, which he is still the head of, regardless. Being broke makes him feel guilty. Get a little cash, you're guiltier still. He pees in an alley, unashamed. It occurs to him further that he could take a Greyhound bus out of here, ride that skinny dog into the sweet distance. The way his own sons raise up to him sometimes, all that wrangle in their eyes. He will write the letter for Cotter, to excuse his absence from school, as he had a fever of 102, make the boy feel better about things. It also occurs to him that he's approaching the corner where the street preacher spoke earlier in the evening, or last night. And then he realizes, no, he's confused. He's still 10 blocks north of there. Then he forgets this and looks around for the man. The man's gone, of course, to wherever he goes. And this isn't his corner anyway. And there's nothing moving but a car or two. Cars with mystery drivers coming out of the gloom, alive like insects all hours of the night. $32 and change. He feels the familiar stab of betrayal. Be messing with his head. Tricked him every which way. The baseball's bound to appreciate, is the word. And the cash be worth less by the minute. He looks in doorways for the preacher because he wants to give him the money. Get it off his hands. He wants to push the money in the old man's clothes just to be done with it. Give it to someone with a scientific interest in the stuff. Bullshit, man. Money's his, and he'll keep it. Take a bus somewhere. Or a room in some shambly street only a mile from home. Find a woman who'll look at him when her eyes sweep the room. He forgets where he is again. He walks. He wants to walk. He's writing the letter in his head. Please excuse my son from school yesterday. He hears the rumble and grind of a garbage truck around a corner somewhere. Cars moving, trains running under the street. He's the only walking soul. Old Charles be laughing up his sleeve for tricking old Max. Tell his kid we gulled that fool. Flat enough to pocket conveniently, with a cap on a chain. He comes into his street and goes past the shoe repair and the beauty school. His hand hurts where it touched hot metal. It's beginning to get light when he reaches his building. He goes inside and climbs the stairs, each step taking basically a year. This is how it seems to Manx, until he is age 80 when he reaches his floor. He goes in the door, shadow soft, a silence with a set of eyes, and he moves slowly across the kitchen. The alarm clock goes off in the bedroom. He sits at the kitchen table and waits. She comes out in her nightdress and slippers, Ivy, the wife, and sees he hasn't been to bed and looks him over slowly. She says, "What's this?" "Need to put some butter on it." "It's all blistered up. I don't like the looks of this." "Just a surface burn."
"This election night? I thought election night was bonfires. I don't like the looks of this at all."
"You go on and get dressed. I take care of it."
"Not with butter, you won't. That's old folks' nonsense," she says. "Do you more harm than good."
She takes the fruit out of the fruit bowl and fills the bowl with cold water and gets an ice tray out of the freezer.
"This doesn't help. We're taking you to emergency."
"I don't require no emergency." She drops 10 or 12 ice cubes into the water and sits next to him, holding his hand in the bowl of ice water and looking him over slowly. She keeps her questions, if she has them, for later. Maybe the pain is subsiding slightly. Maybe it's not. The water is so cold he only feels the cold. He tries to take his hand out of the bowl, but Ivy keeps it there, her own hand pressing firmly on his, and Manx looks away, too tired to make a struggle of it. "This only helps if the burn is recent," she says. "If the burn's not recent, we have to see what they can do for you in emergency."
"And I'm telling you, I don't require no emergency."
They sit like this a while, her hand pressing his into the melting ice, and then she has to dress and go to work. Manx remains at the table, staring at his hand in the water, and waiting for his son to wake up. Part 6. Arrangement in Gray and Black. Fall 1951 to Summer 1952. Chapter 1. Bronzini thought that walking was an art. He was out nearly every day after school, letting the route produce a medley of sounds and forms and movements, letting the voices fall and the aromas deploy in ways that varied, but not too much, from day to day. He stopped to talk to card players in a social club and watched a woman buy a flounder in the market. He peeled a tangerine and wondered how a flatfish lying glassy on flaked ice, a thing scraped with a net from the dim sea, could seem so eloquent a fellow creature. Its deadness was a force in those bulging eyes, such intense emptiness. He thought of the old device of double-take, how it comically embodies the lapsed moment where a life used to be. He watched an apron boy wrap the fish in a major headline. Even in this compact neighborhood, there were streets to revisit and men doing interesting jobs. Day labor, painters in drip coveralls, or men with sledgehammers he might pass the time with. Sicilians busting up a sidewalk, faces grained with stone dust. The less a job pays, Bronzini thought, the harder the work, the more impressive the spectacle. Or a waiter having a smoke during a lull, one of those fast-aging men who are tired all the time. The waiters had tired lives, three jobs, backaches, and bad feet. They were more tired than the men in red neckerchiefs who swung the heavy hammers. They smoked and coughed and told him how tired they were, and looked for a place on the sidewalk where they might situate the phlegm they were always spitting up. He ate the last wedge of tangerine and left the market, holding the spiral rind in his hand. He walked slowly north, glancing in shop windows. There were silver points of hair in his brush mustache, still so few they were countable, and he wore rimless spectacles with wire temples, because at 38, or so said his wife, he wanted to convince himself he was older, settled in his contentments, all the roilsome things finally buttoned and done. He heard voices and looked down a side street filled with children playing. A traffic stanchion carried a sign marking the area a play street and blocking the way to cars and delivery trucks. With cars, more cars, with the status hunger, the hot horsepower, the silver smash of chrome, Bronzini saw that the pressure to free the streets of children would make even these designated areas extinct. He imagined a fragment of chalked pavement cut clean and lifted out and elaborately packed, shipped to some museum in California, where it would share the hushed sunlight with marble carvings from antiquity. Street drawing, hopscotch, chalk on paved asphalt, Bronx, 1951. But they don't call it hopscotch, do they? It's Patsy or Potsy here. It's Buck Buck, not Johnny on the Pony. It's hang-go-seek. You count to 100 by fives and set out into alleyways, shinnying up laundry poles and over back fences, sticking your head into coal bins to find the hiding players. Bronzini stood and watched. Girls playing jacks and jumping double dutch. Boys at boxball, marbles, and ring-olivio. Five boys each with a foot in a segmented circle that had names of countries marked in the wedges. China, Russia, Africa, France, and Mexico. The kid who was it stands at the center of the circle with a ball in his hand and slowly chants the warning words, "I declare a war upon..." Bronzini didn't own a car. Didn't drive a car. Didn't want one. Didn't need one. Wouldn't take one if somebody gave it to him. Stop walking, he thought, and you die. George the waiter stood smoking near the service entrance of the restaurant where he worked. He was a face on a pole, a man not yet out of his 30s who carried something stale and unspontaneous, an inward tension that kept him apart. Over the spare body, a white shirt with black vest and black trousers, and above the uniform, his jut features, looking a little blood-sucked. Bronzini walked over and took up a position next to George, and they stood without speaking for a long moment in the odd solidarity two strangers might share watching a house burn down. Three boys and a girl played down the river against the side of a building, each kid occupying a box formed by separations in the sidewalk. One of them slap-bounced a ball diagonally off the pavement so that it hit up against the wall and veered off into another player's box. He was George the waiter in a second sense, that his life seemed suspended in some dire expectation. What is George waiting for? Bronzini couldn't help seeing a challenge here. He liked to educe comment from the untalkative man, draw him forth, make him understand that his wish to be friendless was not readily respected here. Then the second player bounced the ball into someone else's box, hitting it hard or lightly, slicing at the lower half of the ball to give it English, and so on up and down the river. "The thing about these games," Bronzini said, "they mean so much while you're playing. All your inventive skills, all your energies. But when you get a little older and stop playing, the games escape the mind completely." In fact, he'd played only sporadically as a child, being bedridden at times, that awful word, and treated for asthma, for recurring colds and sore throats and whooping cough. "How we used to scavenge. We turned junk into games, gouging cork out of bottle caps. I don't even remember what we used it for. Cork, rubber bands, tin cans, half a skate, old linoleum that we cut up and used in carpet guns. Carpet guns were dangerous." He checked his watch as he spoke.
"You talk about the cork," George said.
"What was the cork for?"
"We used the cork to make cages for flies. Two flat pieces of cork. Then we got straight pins from the dressmaker, which were all over the floor of the shop."
"My God, you're right," Bronzini said.
"We stuck the pins between the cork discs. One disc is the floor, one is the ceiling. The pins are the bars. Then we waited for a fly to land somewhere. A horsefly on a wall. You cup your hand and move it slowly along the wall and come up behind the fly. Then we put the fly in the cage. Then we put in extra pins," George said, "sealing the fly."
"Then what? I don't remember."
"We watched it buzz."
"We watched it buzz. Very educational."
"It buzzed until it died. If it took too long to die, somebody lit a match. Then we put the match in the cage."
"My God, what terror," Bronzini said. But he was delighted. He was getting George to talk. How children adapt to available surfaces, using curbstones, stoops, and manhole covers. How they take the pockmarked world and turn a delicate inversion, making something brainy and rule-bound and smooth, and then spend the rest of their lives trying to repeat the process. Directly across the street, George the barber was sweeping the floor of his shop. Voices from Italian radio drifted faintly out the open door. Bronzini watched a man walk in, a custodian from the high school, and George put away the broom and took a fresh linen sheet out of a drawer and had it unfolded and sail billowing, timed just right as the man settled into the chair.
"Maybe you heard, Albert. The hunchback diet that used to carve things out of soap?"
"We're going back a few years.
He carved naked women out of soap. Like anatomical. The hunchback that used to sit outside the grocery.
Attilio. You'd give him a bar of soap, he'd carve something."
"What's his name died? The softball player. The pitcher that threw windmill. He had shrapnel from the war.
He had shrapnel actually in his heart from in the war that only now killed him.
Jackie, somebody. You and he.
We used to work together at the beach, but I barely knew him. George used to sell ice cream at the beach. Bronzini saw him many times deep-stepping through the sand with a heavy metal cooler slung over his shoulder and a pith helmet rocking on his head, and white shirt and white ducks, and the day somebody got a cramp while George sold popsicles in Section 10.
"Remember the drowned man?" Bronzini said.
They were playing Salugi in the street. Two boys snatched a schoolbook belonging to one of the girls, a Catholic schoolgirl in a blue pinafore and white blouse. They tossed the book back and forth, and she ran from one boy to the other, and they threw the book over her head and behind her back. The book had a thick brown craft cover that Bronzini was sure the girl had made herself, folding and tucking the grainy paper, printing her name in blue ink on the front, name and grade and subject. "Salugi!" they cried. That strange word. Maybe some corruption of the Italian saluto. Maybe a mock salutation. "Hello, we've got your hat. Now try and get it back." Another boy joined the game, and the girl ran from one to the other, scatterhanded, after the flying book. Or Hindi, or Persian, or some Northumbrian nonce word sifting down the centuries. There was so much to know that he would die not knowing.
"What about the kid?" George said. "I'm hearing things that I don't know if it's good or what."
"He's coming along. I'm pleased one day, exasperated the next."
"I have respect for people that can play that game. When I think to myself, this kid is how old?"
"I try not to lose sight of that very thing, George."
"I hear he beats experienced players. This could be good or bad. Not that I'm the expert here, but I'm thinking maybe he should be in the street with these other kids."
"The street is not ready for Matty."
"You should impress into him those other things."
"He does other things besides playing chess. He cries and screams."
George didn't smile. He was standing off, faded into old brooding, and he sucked the last bland fumes from his cigarette. One drag too many. Then he dropped the butt and stepped on it with the tap-toe of his way-weary shoe, the border of uniformed George, rutted and cut across the instep.
"Time I show my face inside. Be good, Albert."
"We'll talk again," Bronzini said.
He walked across the street so he could wave to George the barber.
How children adapt, using brick walls and lamp posts and fire hydrants.
He watched a girl tying one end of her jump rope to a window grill and getting her little brother to turn the other end. Then she stood in the middle and jumped. No history, no future. He watched a boy playing handball against himself, hitting Chinese killers. The high-bounce rubber ball, the pink spalding, wrapping back from the brick facade. And the fullness of a moment in the play street. Unable to imagine you will ever advance past the pencil line on the kitchen wall your mother has drawn to mark your height. The barber waving back. Bronzini went to the corner past a man unloading jerry cans of Bulgarian sheep cheese from the trunk of a beat-up car. He walked north again, the savor of sweet peel in his hand. He realized he was still holding the fruit rind. It made him think of Morocco. He'd never been there, or much of anywhere, and wondered why the frailest breath of tangerine might bring to mind a reddish sandscape flashing to infinity.
"Buck, buck, how many horns are up?"
The clear cry reached him as he tossed the skin toward some cartons stacked at a cellar entrance. They are jumping on the backs of their play pals. It's usually the fattest boy who serves as cushion, standing against a wall or pole while the boys on one team stoop head to end and their rivals run and jump one by one and come yowling down. With the stooped boys swaying under the weight, the leader of the mounted team holds fingers aloft and calls out the question, "How many horns are up?" Bronzini tried to recall whether the padded boy, the slapped and prodded roly-poly, the one who dribbles egg cream down his chin,
Is he officially called the Pillow or the Pillar? Bronx boys don't know from pillars, he decided. Make him the mothery casing stuffed with down. 4:20. The appointment was 10 minutes hence, and he knew that even if he arrived after the specified time, he would not be late, because Father Paulus was certain to be later. Bronzini envied the blithe arrivals of life's late people. How do they manage the courage to be late? Enact the rude dare repeatedly in our waiting faces. A goat and 4 rabbits were hung upside down in a window, trussed at the hind legs, less affectingly dead than the flounder in the market, dumb, scuzzy fur with nothing to impart. Envy and admiration both. He took it that these people refused to be mastered by the pettier claims of time and conscience. The butcher appeared at the door of his shop, flushed and hoarse, loud, foul, happy in his unwashed apron. A man who lived urgently, something inside him pushing outward, surging against his chest wall.
Albert, I don't see you no more.
You're seeing me now. You see me all the time. I bought a roast last week.
Don't tell me last week. What's last week?
The butcher called to people walking by. He called across the street to insult a man or engage a particular woman with knowing references. The rasping, spitty, sandblast voice. Other women twisted their mouths, amused and disgusted.
What are you feeding that genius of yours?
He's not mine, Bronzini said.
Be thankful. That was my kid. I'd drive him out to the country and leave him on a hillside. But I wait for the dead of winter.
We let him chew on a crayon once a week.
Feed the little jerk some capocel. It makes him ballsy.
The butcher gestured at the whole lamb hanging in the window. Bronzini imagined the broiled head hot from the oven and sitting on a plate in front of Matty. 2 cooked heads regarding each other. And Albert is telling the boy he has to eat the brain and eyes and principal ganglia, or no more chess.
They put some lead in this pencil.
The butcher stood at the corner of the window, looking well-placed among the dangled animals, his arms crossed and feet spread. Bronzini saw an aptness and balance here. The butcher's burly grace. Watch him trim a chop. See how he belongs to the cutting block, to the wallow of trembling muscle and mess, his aptitude and ease. The sense that he was born to the task restored a certain meaning to these eviscerated beasts. Bronzini thought the butcher's own heart and lungs ought to hang outside his body, stationed like a saint's, to demonstrate his intimate link to the suffering world.
Be good, Albert.
I'll be in tomorrow.
Give my best to the woman,
the butcher said. Bronzini checked his watch again, then stopped at a candy store to buy a newspaper. He was trying to be late, but knew he couldn't manage it. Some force compelled him to walk into the pastry shop, not only on time, but about 2.5 minutes early, which translated to a wait of roughly 20 minutes for the priest. He took a table in the dim interior and unfolded the times across the scarred enamel. A girl brought coffee and a glass of water. The front page astonished him, a pair of 3-column headlines dominating. To his left, the Giants capture the pennant, beating the Dodgers on a dramatic home run in the 9th inning. And to the right, symmetrically mated, same typeface, same size type, same number of lines, the USSR explodes an atomic bomb. Kaboom. Details kept secret. He didn't understand why the Times would take a ball game off the sports page and juxtapose it with news of such ominous consequence. He began to read the account of the Soviet test. He couldn't keep the image from entering his mind. The cloud that was not a cloud. The mushroom that was not a mushroom. The sense of reaching feebly for a language that might correspond to the visible mass in the air. Suddenly, there the priest was, coming in a flurry. Andrew Paulus, S.J., built low and cozy, his head poked forward and that glisten of spittle in his smile. He had books and folders slipping down his hip, but managed to extend a cluster of scrubbed fingers, which Albert gripped in both hands, pressing and shaking, half rising from his chair. It took a moment of clumsy ceremony with overlapping salutations and unheeded questions, and a dropped book and a race to retrieve it, before the two men were settled at the table and all the objects put away. The priest heaved, as they say, a sigh. He wore a Roman collar fitted to a bib-like cloth called a rabi, and over this a dark jacket with pocket square, and he could have been George the waiter's tailored master in black and white.
How late am I?
You're not late at all.
I'm doing a seminar on knowledge. Wonderful fun, but I lose track.
No, you're early, Bronzini said.
How we know what we know.
You had to look hard at Andrew Paulus to find a trace of aging. Unfurrowed and oddly aglow, with a faint baked glaze keeping his skin pink and fresh. Hair pale brown and fringed unevenly across the forehead in boyish bangs. Bronzini wondered if this is what happens to men who forswear a woman's tangling touch and love. They stay a child, preserved in clean and chilly light. But there were parish priests everywhere about, leaky-eyed and halting, their old monotones falling whispery from the pulpit. He decided this man was not youthful so much as ageless. He must be 30 years senior to Albert, and not an eyelid ever trembles, or a bristly whit of gray shows at the jawline.
Did you see the paper, Father?
Please, we know each other too well. You're required to call me Andy now.
Yes, I stole a long look at someone's daily news. They're calling it the shot heard round the world.
How did we detect evidence of the blast, I wonder? We must have aircraft flying near their borders with instruments that measure radiation.
Or well-placed agents, perhaps.
No. We're speaking about the home run. Bobby Thompson's heroic shot. The tabloids have dubbed it for posterity.
Bronzini had to pause to take this in. The shot heard round the world? Is the rest of the world all that interested? This is baseball. I was barely aware. I myself barely knew that something was going on. Heard round the world. I almost missed it completely.
We may take it that the term applies to the suddenness of the struck blow and the corresponding speed at which news is transmitted these days. Our servicemen in Greenland and Japan surely heard the home run call as it was made on Armed Forces Radio.
You're right, of course. They're not talking about this in the coffee houses of Budapest. Although, in fact, poor Ralph Branca happens to be half-Hungarian. Sons of immigrants, Branca and Thompson both. Bobby himself born in Scotland, I believe. You see why our wins and losses tend to have impact well beyond our borders?
You follow baseball, then?
Only in distant memory. But I did devour today's reports. It's all over the radio. Something propelled this event full force into the public imagination. All day, a steady sort of ripple in the air.
I don't follow the game at all, Bronzini said. He fell into remorseful thought. The girl appeared again, sullen in a limp blouse and shuffling loafers. Only 4 tables, theirs the only one occupied. The plain decor, the time-locked thickness in the air, the trace of family smell, even the daughter, discontented, all argued a theme, a non-picturesqueness, that Albert thought the priest might note and approve.
But baseball isn't the game we're here to discuss, Paula said.
In other shops, the priest had made an appreciative show of selecting a pastry from the display case, with moans and exclamations, but was subdued today, gesturing toward the almond biscotti and asking the girl to bring some coffee. Then he squared in his chair and set his elbows firmly on the table, a little visual joke, and framed his head with cupped hands, the player taut above his board.
I've been taking him to chess clubs, Bronzini said, as we discussed last time. He needs this to develop properly. Stronger opponents in an organized setting. But he hasn't done as well as I'd expected. He's been stung a number of times.
And when he's not playing? We spend time studying, practicing. How much time? 3 days a week, usually. A couple of hours each visit. This is completely ridiculous. Go on.
I don't want to force-feed the boy.
Go on, Paula said.
I'm just a neighbor, after all. I can push only so hard. There's no deep tradition here. He just appeared one day. Shazam! A boy from another planet, you know?
He wasn't born knowing the moves, was he?
His father taught him the game. A bookmaker. Evidently kept all the figures in his head. The bets, the odds, the teams, the horses. He could memorize a scratch sheet. This is the story people told. He could look at a racing form with the day's entries, the morning line, the jockeys, and so on, and he could memorize the data of numerous races in a matter of minutes.
And he disappeared.
Disappeared. About 5 years ago.
And the boy is 11, which means Daddy barely got him started.
Adequate or not, on and off, I have been the mentor ever since.
The priest made a gesture of appeasement, a raised hand that precluded any need for further explanation. The girl brought strong black coffee and a glass of water and some biscuits on a plate.
The mother is Irish Catholic, and there's another son, one of my former students, one semester only. Bright, I think, but lazy and unmotivated. He's 16 and can quit school anytime he likes. And I'm speaking on behalf of the mother now. She wondered if you'd be willing to spend an hour with him. Tell him about Fordham, what college might offer such a boy, what the Jesuits offer. Our two schools, Andy, directly across the road from each other and completely remote. My students, some of them don't know. They remain completely unaware of the fact that there's a university lurking in the trees.
Some of my students have the same problem. Bronzini remembered to laugh.
But what a waste if a youngster like this were to end up in a stockroom or garage.
You've made your plea. Consider your duty effectively discharged, Albert.
Dip your biscotto. Don't be bashful. Dip, dip, dip. These biscuits are direct descendants of honey and almond cakes that were baked in leaves and eaten at Roman fertility rites.
I think the task of reproducing the species will have to devolve upon others. Not that I would mind the incidental contact.
Bronzini leaning in. In all seriousness, have you ever regretted...
What, not marrying?
Bronzini nodding, eyes intent behind the lenses.
I don't want to marry.
And now it was the priest's turn to lean forward, shouldering down, sliding his chin near the tabletop.
I just want to screw,
he whispered electrically. Bronzini, shocked and charmed.
The verb to screw is so amazingly, subversively apt. But conjugating the word is not sufficient pastime. I would like to screw a movie star, Albert. The greatest, blondest, biggest-titted goddess Hollywood is able to produce. I want to screw her in the worst way possible. And I mean that in every sense.
The small, toothy head hovered above the table in defiant self-delight. Bronzini felt rewarded. On a couple of past occasions, he'd taken the priest into shops and watched him taste the autumnal pink Parma ham, sliced transparently thin. And he'd offered commentaries on pig's blood pastry and sheets of salt cod. The visitor showed pleasure in the European texture of the street. Things done the old, slow, faithful way. Things carried over, suffused with rules of usage. This is the only art I've mastered, Father, walking these streets and letting the senses collect what is routinely here. And he walked the priest into the acid stink of the chicken market and pushed him toward the old scale hung from the ceiling with a lashed bird in the weighing pan, explaining how the poultryman gets 20 cents extra to kill and dress the bird. Say something in Latin, Father. And he felt the priest's own shudder when the deadpan Neapolitan snapped the chicken's neck, a wiry man with feathers in his shirt. If I were not so dull a husband, we might sit here and tell stories into the night.
Yours real, mine phantasmal.
The priest's confession was funny and sad and assured Albert that he was a privileged companion, if not yet a trusted friend. He enjoyed being a guide to the complex deposits around them, the little histories hidden in a gesture or word. But he was beginning to fear that Andy's response would never exceed the level of appreciative interest.
And when you were young?
Was I ever in love? Smitten at 7 or 8, piercingly. The purest stuff, Albert. Before the heavy hormones. There was a girl named something or other.
I know a walk we ought to take. There's a play street very near. I think you'd enjoy a moment among the children. It's a dying practice, kids playing in city streets. We'll finish here and go. Another half cup.
He signaled the girl.
Do you know the famous old painting, Albert? Children playing games? Scores of children filling a market square. A painting that's about 400 years old. And what a shock it is to recognize many games we played ourselves. Games still played today.
I'm pessimistic, you think?
Children find a way. They sidestep time, as it were, and the ravages of progress. I think they operate in another time scheme altogether. Imagine standing in a wooded area and throwing stones at the top of a horse chestnut tree to dislodge the sturdiest nuts. Said to be in the higher elevations. Throwing stones all day, if necessary, and taking the best chestnut home and soaking it in salt water.
We used vinegar.
Vinegar, then?
We Italians, Albert said.
Soak it to make it hard and battle-worthy. And poke a hole through the nut with a skewer and slip a tough bootlace through the hole. A lace long enough to wind around the hand 2 or 3 times. It's completely vivid in my mind. Tie a knot, of course, to keep the chestnut secured to the lace. A rawhide lace, if possible.
Then the game begins.
Yes. You dangle your chestnut, and I bash it by launching my own with a sort of dervishy twirl. But it's finding the thing, soaking the thing, taking the time. Time, as we know it now, had not yet come into being.
I tramp through the zoo every year at this time to gather fallen chestnuts, Bronzini said.
Buckeyes.
Buckeyes.
Time, the priest said. Across the room, the girl filled the cups from a machine. Father Paulus waited for her to slide his cup across the table so he could let the aromatic smoke drift near his face. Then he said, "Time, Albert. Both of you must be willing, actually, to pay a much higher price. Hours and days. Whole days at chess. Days and weeks."
Bronzini had his opening, finally.
"And if I'm not willing, are you? Or not able? If I'm not able to do it, not equal to the job, are you, Andy?"
The priest looked at the knot in Albert's tie.
"I thought you wanted advice."
"I do."
"Please. Do you think I'd even consider tutoring the boy? Albert, please. I have a life, such as it is."
"You're far more advanced than I, Father. You're a tournament player. You understand the psychology of the game."
Paulus sat upright in his chair, formally withdrawing, it seemed, to a more objective level of discourse.
"Theories about the psychology of the game, frankly, leave me cold. The game is location, situation, and memory, and a need to win. The psychology is in the player, not the game. He must enjoy the company of danger. He must have a killer instinct. He must be prideful, arrogant, aggressive, contemptuous, and dominating. Willful in the extreme. All the sins, Albert, of the non-carnal type."
Chastened and deflated, but Albert felt he had it coming. The man's remarks were directed at his own genial drift, of course, not the boy's. His complacent and easy pace.
"He shows master strength, potentially."
"Look, I'm willing to attend a match or two. Give you some guidance if I can. But I don't want to be his teacher. No, 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 no."
Now the grandmother appeared with an open bottle of anisette, crusted at the rim. When Bronzini asked how she was feeling, she let her head rock back and forth. The liqueur was a gesture reserved for select customers, and took earning over time. She poured an ashy dram into each demitasse, and the priest colored slightly, as he seemed to do in the close company of people who were markedly different. Their unknown lives disconcerted him, making his smile go stiff and bringing to his cheeks a formal flush of deference. She left without a word. They watched her glide moon-slow into the dimmed inner room.
"I don't know what to tell you about the older brother," Paula said.
"Never mind. I asked only because the mother asked. It'll all straighten itself out."
"We have an idea, some of us, that's taking shape. A new sort of collegium. Closer contact, minimal structure. We may teach Latin as a spoken language. We may teach mathematics as an art form, like poetry or music. We will teach subjects that people don't realize they need to know. All of this will happen somewhere in the hinterland. We'll want a special kind of boy. Special circumstances," Paula said. "Something he is, something he's done, but something."
When they stood to leave and the priest was gathering his books, Bronzini took his cup, the priest's, and drained it of sediment, tipping his head quickly. Espresso dregs steeped in anisette. They shook hands and made vague plans to stay in touch, and Father Paula started on the short walk back to the Fordham campus. And Albert realized he'd forgotten his own suggestion about visiting the play street nearby. Too bad. They might have ended on a mellower note. But when he walked past the street, it was nearly emptied out. A few boys still playing Ring Alivio, haphazard and half-speed, the clumsy fat boy trapped in the den, always caught, always it, the slightly epicene, butterfat bulk, the boy who's always reaching down to lift a droopy sock and getting swift-kicked by the witlings and sadists. Is that what being it means? Neutered, sexless, impersonalized? Dark now. Another day of games all ended, or nearly all. He could hear the boy's following voices as he made his way down the avenue. And when it ends completely, we find ourselves abandoned to our sodden teens. What a wound to overcome, this passage out of childhood. But a beautiful injury, too, he thought, pure and unrepeatable. Only the scab remains, barely seen, the exuded substance. "Ring Alivio, Coca-Cola, 1, 2, 3. A faint whiff of knishes and hot dogs from the luncheonette under the bowling alley. Then Albert crossed the street to Mussolini Park, as the kids called it, where a few old men still sat on benches with their folded copies of Il Progresso. The fresh air inspectors, retired, indifferent, or otherwise idle, and they smoked and talked and blew their noses in the street, leaning over the curbstone with thumb and index finger clamped to old Schnozzola, discharging the stringy stuff. Albert wanted to linger a while, but didn't see anyone he knew, and so he joined the small army of returning workers coming around the bend from Third Avenue, from the buses and elevated train. Time, finally, to go home.
This ends Disc 22.